Welcome to Design You with Dr. Garrison Lakem. I'm your host, Garrison. My guest today is a teacher, researcher, and meditation expert at Stanford University, specializing in the application of mindfulness and compassion in secular contexts. Her waitlisted course at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, called Leading with Mindfulness and Compassion, is breaking new ground in an MBA program already famous for innovation. In fact, her best-selling book, How We Work, Live Your Purpose, Reclaim Your Sanity, and Embrace the Daily Grind, is based on this course and is a practical guide to bringing our whole selves to our professional work. In addition to Stanford Business School, my guest has taught and consulted at Harvard-affiliated hospitals, the Stanford School of Medicine, the Stanford Bing Institute, Google headquarters, the Young Presidents Organization, and the list goes on and includes the Department of Veterans Affairs, where she teaches mindfulness and compassion to help veterans cope with post-traumatic stress and to help VA staff around the Bay Area cope with the stress of their jobs helping veterans. I'd like to welcome to Design You with Dr. Garrison Lakem, Leah Weiss. Welcome, Leah.
Thank you so much for having me.
His Holiness the Dalai Lama said of your book, How We Work, "I have long thought that what the Buddha taught can be seen as a highly developed science of mind, which, if made more accessible to a lay audience, could benefit many people." I believe that Dr. Weiss's book, in combining such insights with science and good business practice, offers an effective mindfulness-based program that many will find helpful. Leah, what was your personal motivation to write a book that it's accomplished such an inspiring goal?
Well, thank you. My interest in writing this book really came out of a combination of the teaching that I've been doing for some years at the Stanford Business School and wanting to make more broadly accessible the curriculum that I've developed there. And also, you know, I think fundamentally, I've been interested in how can we, people with busy lives, with work, with families, with a lot of commitments, how can we benefit from a practical, accessible approach to mindfulness and compassion and self-compassion to live more purposeful lives? So that's what I've been about.
Now, why is the dichotomy between work and personal in today's workplace false? And how does it, in fact, work against our own happiness and professional success?
Well, I think one of the mistakes that people make is feeling like they can't and shouldn't be themselves at work. And over time, what happens when we develop these personas at work that aren't true to who we are, then we lose track of ourselves. And the problem is that it's also not effective. People know when someone is being authentic or not. And when people are in a climate right now where we have such low levels of workplace engagement, it's really an epidemic that people are not engaged. They don't feel purposeful. They don't stay at their jobs. And I think that this ties in directly that if leadership and organizations can communicate purpose and a real reason, the why behind what they're trying to do and trying to get from their employees, then everybody is better off, they're more effective, and they have greater well-being and happiness.
I don't think anyone would disagree that everyone has experienced stress at work and the anxiety, anger, envy, fear, and paranoia that are inherent in it. How do we avoid pushing these emotions under the rug and come to terms with them for the betterment of not just ourselves, but also our employers and our colleagues?
So I think the first thing that's really useful is to understand the research around emotions. And there's a few clear points that we know about how emotions work. Emotions are physiological. They're rooted in the body, and they're not something that we can just turn on or off. There's different strategies we can use to work with them. But suppression, which is often the one that people will try to do if they're at work and they don't want to feel, they don't want to look unprofessional, if you try to stuff your emotions, stuff your frustrations, suppress them, it actually will backfire by causing you to have negative health outcomes. And eventually, you know, it's like the metaphor of the balloon that we're pushing in on one side. It'll pop in an inopportune moment. So what's better to do is learn effective strategies to deal with stress and emotions at work. And we have those. We understand what works for people: mental flexibility, mindfulness, acceptance of difficult emotions. These are all skills that we can learn that will be invaluable to us when we're under pressure. And, you know, the other thing that I would add to this is there's the neuroscience of trying to work, trying to think, trying to function when we are experiencing a strong emotion. Our cognitive resources are hijacked. We have to spend so much of our brain power, if you will, in being invested in just experiencing those emotions and trying to engage with them. There's nothing left over for us to think and problem solve. And I think we've all had that experience where we're really upset. Are you going to be able to do effective work? No, we can't. So the question becomes, how can you downregulate? How can you effectively work with stress and difficult emotions so that you can bring your cognitive resources back online?
You know, I think it's true, Leah, today more than ever before, that the grass is greener dynamic causes people to find happiness by changing jobs. And one of my favorite quotes of yours is, the path to productivity and success is not to change jobs, to compartmentalize our feelings, or to create a false professional identity, but rather to listen to the wisdom our feelings offer. How do we do that, Leah, when there's so much pressure at work to avoid our feelings literally at all costs?
Well, I think part of what we need to know is that we can change our habitual responses. And it takes time, just like any new behavior that we're trying to enlist, like if we're going from an unhealthy diet to a healthy diet, if we're trying to bring in exercise, all of those things take time. You can't flip a switch and do it overnight to really feel the impact of it. And similarly, learning to understand, to have emotional intelligence, to be clear about while we're triggered, while we're working, what's happening, what we call the emotional narration capacity, meaning we know what we're feeling, we're clear on it. It sounds simple, but it's actually hard to do. And then we can get better and better at working with challenging emotions and having the supportive skills around that to be able to productively communicate what we're feeling and what we're thinking, to know how and when to do that, to be able to calm ourselves back down and get ourselves on track. But I think the biggest roadblock to that is that people don't realize that there's an alternative to suppression and that there are ways to get much better at this, and we can learn them. That's the kind of stuff I teach in my class and wrote about in my book.
You mentioned that very important word called time. Almost everybody in a job tries to handle the push-pull of professional and personal, and not having enough hours in the day to do it all. With your expertise, what are some very simple and practical tools that can help anyone keep calm amid the career chaos and regain a sense of purpose?
I think one of the key things that we need to do is understand what our fundamental purpose is and to make sure that we are executing our priorities and where we're spending our time and our actions – against that purpose. And I think we can get really overwhelmed and distracted of all the things on the to-do list and lose track of what is the most important thing to do now. And there's a lot that can play into that. It's distraction. It's also discomfort. Sometimes the most important thing to do can also, you know, be frightening in different ways. Like, you know, it might mean putting ourselves out there or taking a risk, or maybe there's a piece of the project we're not clear on that we need to go have a conversation about or get support with. And it seems easier in the moment to just distract ourselves to go to a different task on the list. But then the stress builds because this really was the priority, and we know that in the days past, and we don't do the thing that we most need to do. So I think really coming back to, like, what is my purpose for me, not just personally, but in this role, what is the biggest priority, making sure that everyone is aligned on that, and, you know, not, and learning to tolerate the discomfort in really engaging with the most, with the highest priorities, so we don't get into procrastination and distraction just to avoid that discomfort.
You mentioned the word purpose, and oftentimes I think of purpose as aligned with values, our personal and our professional values. What advice would you give someone in the throes of, shall we call it, career angst in writing their own value proposition? And on a bigger scale, what is the new value proposition?
Yeah, I think that just starting with getting clarity is really important. I have a tool actually on my website that is a purpose mission statement. And what it seeks to do is support people in unbundling, you know, what often, if someone's unhappy in their career for various reasons, you have to then unbundle what's going on in that situation with what is it that you really want from your life, and getting clarity about that, and then figuring out what are the steps to be moving towards that, what are the decisions that need to be made. So I think purpose is really important. The metaphor that I write about in the book I got from one of my students, who's from a military family. His father was a general of the Army Corps of Engineers, and he raised his children to do puzzles. And as they got older, the puzzles got more complex. And before they went off to West Point, they had to do a very elaborate puzzle with no box top. And the metaphor that they took away from that very practical experience is, if you don't know directionally what you're building, if you don't have that vision in mind, it becomes even impossible to do it. So there's, I think, taking it step by step, and also having the resources to know that when fear and concern and sort of self-criticism or whatever blocks come up in our process of clarifying our purpose and our next step, if we can, you know, take the steps of writing things out and having people that we talk to about it, whether it's a colleague that we trust or someone in our community, it helps us make steps just to have, like, that accountability that we're going to work on getting this clarity and doing it one step at a time. And that's why coaches and therapists can be very helpful in this process as well.
When we think of all the dynamics we bring to work, both our work and our personal dynamics, it suggests that we have other selves, almost multiple selves, that we're trying to integrate and make compatible. And I was wondering if you could give any insight into how many personas, if you will, we all try to deal with.
I think in terms of we have different habits of thought or different, you know, scripts or, you know, loops or tracks that get played. And sometimes those are internalized voices from early in our life, maybe a parent or a teacher. And that can be supportive. It can be the opposite of supportive. So I think I think if you start a mindfulness practice, one of the first things you realize is there are so many different kinds of thoughts and emotions that are happening in the background all the time. There's all this noise, and recognizing that there's Some that are, you know, there's an aspect of us or a train of thought that wants to grow and develop and be healthier and more productive. Then there's, you know, parts of us that are self-critical and are, you know, lines of thinking that are saying you'll never do it and, you know, you're going to get found out and you're going to mess up. And then, you know, there's fear maybe of other people or fear of even success. So I think what happens with our increased self-awareness is we recognize what our specific patterns of thought are so that they don't have the same amount of power over us. So if we're having a self-critical thought, we can recognize that that's a self-critical thought, stop attacking ourselves, and even be compassionate towards ourselves. But it all starts with recognizing what these patterns are rather than just reinforcing them and, you know, chasing them around.
The fear of messing up that you mentioned, you know, one of the words we hate to think about in the office or at work is failure. How do we define failure and how do we deal with it when we experience it?
I think failure is a really interesting concept because, you know, in Silicon Valley, everybody is always talking about fail fast, like get your idea out there and test it quickly. You don't want to be waiting in the laboratory for perfection. You want to prototype and be first to market, even if you still have to make improvements as you go. So there are some cultures that support the concept of failure, but that doesn't mean that the individuals involved are comfortable with their product being imperfect or them being the ones who made a mistake that becomes the problem. So there's a breakdown there. And then I think there's other industries where failure is less celebrated, that we don't celebrate for physicians failures, right? Like that's unacceptable to us. So I think it depends on the industry and what failure looks like in that context. And there are certain kinds of failures, like maybe a surgeon will fail in the sense that they couldn't save the life of a patient because there's no ability in terms of the medicine we have and the treatment potential to save that person. But there's other kinds of failure, like human error, what physicians will call never events, that, you know, operating on the wrong side or the wrong site is wildly problematic, and that's a kind of failure that would, you know, ruin a person's career and certainly have core identity problematics with it. But I think what can be helpful is to really take, like you're suggesting with this question, for us as a person in the work that we're doing and the roles that we have, you know, what does failure mean to me as an author, as a teacher, as a wife, as a mother, as a daughter, as a friend, and understand from that, that helps us get a line of sight into our values and our purpose and what matters to us. And some of the fears that we have around failure are realistic, and some of them are just old information, like coming from the scripts that, you know, the kinds of thoughts we were talking about just before, they're old information. They're not a real risk, but we're wasting energy trying to avoid something that has no real risk of happening. So I think it's really worth unbundling this failure thing and seeing how to even the small mistakes we make, how do we respond to those? Do we go into a cycle of self-deprecation, self-criticism, and take a really long time to be able to come out of that so we can figure out how to make things better? Or can we tolerate the discomfort of making a mistake and own it and take responsibility and take the next steps to try to fix it? And that's a huge differentiator for a leader and just in a person with integrity, how quickly, we don't have to be perfect, but how quickly can we be resilient when we've made a mistake?
I never fail to be amazed at how conditioned we are and the lengths we'll go to keep our emotions at bay, and especially in the workplace, which is why I love the term that you frequently use, the wisdom of emotions. Maybe you could explain, how do we transition from literally suppression as an unhealthy coping mechanism to mindfulness strategies so that we can embrace our own emotional intelligence?
Yeah, I think that it's a great question. And what we want to start with is this ability to recognize what we're feeling, ideally real time. But if we can't do that when we are looking back at a situation, trying to get in touch with what are we feeling and remembering that emotions aren't just existing in outer space, they actually exist in our body. So emotions are always tied to sensations. So the first step is really like, can we get good at, while we're moving through our days and doing different tasks and in different relationships, knowing what we're feeling while we're feeling it. Being in our bodies more is a big piece of that. And when we have that ability, then we know when we start to get angry or afraid or frustrated. And when we know that that's happening, then we can make the choice to earlier on insert some kind of a tool that will help us. Because the thing is once, if we can catch it upstream, if we can catch it early, then we can understand what's going on and make a good choice. If we get totally carried away with emotion, then we become reactive in a way that's not helpful to us or other people. So I think that's really the first place, and a meditation practice is very supportive of this. But ultimately, we have to be able to do that while we're in the meeting with the difficult coworker, or we're, you know, in the difficult conversation with our partner or spouse, because that's where the rubber meets the road. When we are triggered, when we are experiencing a strong emotion, what is our ability to recognize that and be able to do something with it so that we can behave in a way that's of service to the relationship and our real goals, not just wielded by our emotion like a puppet.
Leah, where can listeners pick up their very own copy of How We Work, and where can they follow you online and engage you as a speaker? And you mentioned on your website that there's a purpose mission statement that's available. How do listeners engage you?
The best way for us to keep in touch is if you go to my website, which is Leah Weiss, PhD, and sign up for a newsletter. You can find resources there. And then I'm continuing to develop tools, and that's also the best way to reach out to me if you're interested in having a workshop, a course, or a talk at your company or organization.
Leah, I can't thank you enough for being a very special guest on Design You with Dr. Garrison Lakem, and I look forward to you coming back again.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.